From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Ever wonder how coffee came to inhabit nearly every facet of our culture? That's one of the questions we look into this hour with author Mark Pendergrast. His new book, Uncommon Grounds, recounts the history of coffee and how it transformed our world. We'll also talk with a man who runs a coffee shop at a church in Ames, the owner of a coffee shop in a West Des Moines library, and a computer programmer who aims to visit every Starbucks in the world. He's already been to nearly 10,000 of them. Clues about our coffee culture after a look at this news. So glad you could join us over the noon hour. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Well, we have to go back to the middle of the 15th century, to the Sufi monasteries of Yemen in southern Arabia, to find the earliest credible evidence of it. It was featured in religious ceremonies. From the Muslim world, it spread to Italy, then to the rest of Europe, and eventually to us in the Americas. What is the it I am describing? Coffee drinking, of course. Coffee has played an important role in many societies throughout history. Today, though, you get a cup of coffee anywhere, the library, the grocery store, even at church. This hour, we want to take a look into coffee house culture in the United States and in Iowa. We'll be speaking with the creative arts director of Cornerstone Church in Ames, a congregation with a coffee shop, also the owner of Darby's at the House of Books, the coffee shop in the West Des Moines Library, and talk to a computer programmer who aims to visit every Starbucks in the world. Yes, every one of them. He's already been to nearly 10,000 of them. And we want to have you help us probe our fascination for this dark brew that so many of us enjoy and depend on. What does coffee mean to you? What would your life be like without it? Do you have a personal experience that relates to coffee you'd like to tell us about? 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or via email, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Joining us first of all, from Vermont by phone, Mark Pendergrast. He is the author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. Good afternoon to you, Mr. Pendergrast.
Hello.
Great to have you with us. Take us on a fast-forward history, if you could, first of all, of coffee's history, touching on some major landmarks. Where do we start?
Sure. You start in Ethiopia, in the mountains of Ethiopia, where coffee was probably used even before the 1400s, but they hadn't figured out to roast it yet. It was ground up and put in animal fat for sort of a quick energy boost by some of the tribes, and they made a kind of a wine out of the pulp of the coffee cherry. But, you know, let me also mention what coffee actually comes from, because a lot of people probably don't know. Although it's called a bean, it is in fact really a berry. It grows on an understory tree or shrub in a rainforest, usually high up on mountainsides in tropical areas, and you get the cherry when it's, or they call them coffee cherries, when they are red and ripe, and somehow or other get the seed out. It's a double-sided seed, kind of like a peanut. Mm-hmm. And then someone figured out to roast them and grind them up and brew them in hot water sometime in the 1400s. And as you mentioned, they were used at first by the Sufi monks to keep awake at night and by the dervishes to aid their whirling. But they quickly went into secular use, became extremely popular throughout the Arab world. Eventually, the Europeans discovered them around 1650. So that by 1700, coffee had taken Europe in a huge flood, mm-hmm. which transformed European culture. Up until then, people had drunk alcohol and were drunk a lot of the time. So coffee really did have a major impact, and coffee houses had a major impact. There were about 2,000 of them in London alone by the year 1700. The cultivation spread, even though the Arabs tried to keep it a monopoly for many years. They succeeded, but eventually the Dutch got some fertile beans and grew them in their greenhouses, and then began to grow them in the East Indies, in Java and Ceylon. The French got hold of some and began to grow them in the West Indies, in Martinique, and in what became Haiti. A lot of this involved slavery and oppression. It also involved planning revolutions in coffee houses. So it's quite an interesting history. The Americans really adopted coffee after the Boston Tea Party, when it became a patriotic duty to drink coffee rather than tea. It also happened to be cheaper to drink coffee, which was grown at that time. It began to be grown a lot more in places like Brazil.
Go into that a little more. Follow up on the coffee versus tea. They have both gone back for centuries. Mm-hmm. What can we tell about the culture, depending on whether it's a tea-drinking culture, as Britain still is, even though they drink coffee there, or mm-hmm. a coffee-drinking culture, which you would find in northern, the continental part of Europe?
Well, it's fascinating the way that the drinks have evolved in terms of their image. Coffee has more of a sort of aggressive, macho image, and it's supposed to, you know, sort of jumpstart you into your day. Tea is more effete and civilized, and there's the zen of tea drinking. In fact, they both are caffeine-bearing beverages. They both came to Europe about the same time. And it's interesting. Most people think of the British as primarily tea drinking. They now drink about as much coffee as tea, and they started out as coffee drinkers. They went to tea primarily because the British East India Company pushed it. And also, the coffee houses in Britain wouldn't allow women, whereas tea became a public event. So the coffee houses eventually evolved into the private men's club mm-hmm. in England.
Could this be also because coffee, I think, generally has a bigger caffeine kick than most teas, right?
Yeah, it has about. It's funny. The tea leaf has a considerable more caffeine per ounce than coffee does. But when you brew the drinks, tea has about half as much caffeine as coffee. So coffee is a stronger drink.
Coming to the U.S. With our fast forward through history, how and when did coffee house culture really take hold in the United States? You said the start was after the Boston Tea Party.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had coffee houses early on. They were also taverns. So they served both alcohol and coffee. I would say coffee houses per se have had a varied time in the United States. Once we adopted coffee, we didn't really have them in coffee houses. People mostly, they would roast them at home in their frying pan or in a little home roaster. It wasn't really until the 1920s when a woman named Alice Foote McDougall was inspired by a trip to Italy that coffee houses became sort of the rage, at least in New York City. Prohibition aided them. Then there was another lull, and in the 1950s, the sort of bohemian Greenwich Village and San Francisco coffee houses where beat poets would read their stuff and people would sing, et cetera, became popular. And then you had another sort of lull. And finally, with the recent upsurge in specialty coffees and Starbucks, coffee houses have become much, much more popular, so much so that there's an author named Ray Oldenburg who wrote a book called The Great Good Place, where he was talking about the importance of a community meeting place that's not work, it's not your home, where people can get together and discuss and socialize. It used to be that we had soda fountains for that, but we really didn't have anything for a long time. Certainly, your local bar wouldn't really work that way. Mm-hmm. But now I think coffee houses do serve that purpose quite well in the United States and around the world.
So did Starbucks, with this latest coffee upsurge, did it create a groundswell, this revolution upswell in coffee drinking, or did it hop on some sort of wave that was recognized or happened to be at the right time at the right place?
Both. I would say that Starbucks deserves a great deal of credit for pushing that wave harder, but basically coffee had been ruined in the United States by the large commercial companies such as Maxwell House and Folgers and Hills Brothers. They got into coupons off wars and price cutting after World War II, and they began to cheapen their blends and put more and more Robusta beans in, which are an inferior type of coffee, which has more caffeine but tastes bitter. And it was really in the mid-60s that the beginnings of the specialty coffee revolution began, of the rediscovery that coffee is like wine. Different beans coming from different places taste slightly different. And so you can have a single origin. They also were rediscovering that coffee, if it's freshly roasted and freshly ground, is miles different from the diner coffee, which has been sitting there on the hot plate getting stale and bitter all day. And it really, I traced it to Pete's Coffee, which began in 1966 in Berkeley, if that's as good a place as any to start it. Starbucks was directly inspired by Pete's, the original Starbucks, which began in 1971 by three partners who are no longer associated with it. And then it really turned into what we know as Starbucks beginning in 1987 when Howard Schultz bought it and began to turn it into a beverage chain. Up until then, they had roasted really good coffee beans, but they'd sold them to people to brew at home.
Mm-hmm. And we also have this sort of competing culture now. We have the grab-and-go culture of coffee, don't we?
Well, we've always had a grab-and-go culture of coffee. There's a wonderful song about the trouble with the world today is coffee in a paper cup. I think that was from the 1950s.
Very good.
Too bad you didn't have that to play, actually.
We've got a very good song, nonetheless, to play as we go into this break, and then we'll come back to talk about
excellent. Our
fascination for Java and coffee house culture. Mark Pendergrass is our first guest as we investigate this fascination that we have with the dark brew. And if you'd like to join our conversation, tell us what coffee means to you. What would life be like without it? Perhaps you have a personal experience that relates to coffee you'd like to tell us about. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Mark, this is an Iowa artist, Greg Brown, singing about coffee. We'll be back in a minute. The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, today talking about our fascination for Java and coffee house culture. My first guest, Mark Pendergrass, author of Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World, joining us by phone from Vermont. I want to also add to our conversation, invite Mike Despard. He is the Creative Arts Director for Cornerstone Church in Ames, the congregation with a coffee shop. Good afternoon to you, Mike. You're joining us from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Hi.
Hello.
Tell us about your coffee shop so that we can picture it. This is within the church itself.
Yeah, we have a new facility that we built just this last fall, and we have a large foyer, and so within that is a coffee bar area, also called a cafe, and we just have a long bar that serves our people when they come in before and after church services. So we have about 2,000 people that come into our facility each weekend for our services. So we've got
2,000. You've got a large church.
We have a large church. Yes. So we have lots of people that come and they want to get a cup of coffee before they head into the service or hang out before and after. And so we've got tables set up, lounge chairs, things like that, for them to be able to hang out and fellowship with one another.
So if we went into your coffee shop in the church, would we notice that it was a church coffee shop, or does it look like a nice coffee shop anywhere?
I'd say it looks like a nice coffee shop anywhere. I mean, we've got the dark woods and the tables and the cafe chairs. I mean, obviously, we're within a larger setting, so it's open to the rest of the foyer. It's divided by a couple of open staircase and things like that. So it's got its own corner of the foyer. But generally, yeah, you would say you felt like you're in a coffee shop. Big windows, nice bright light coming in.
Mm-hmm. When you designed the church, not you, but the thought about the design of the church, building this new church, why was it so important to reserve this amount of space for a coffee shop? What does that have to do with worship?
Well, we've had coffee even before we did this new addition. We've been doing it for about 5 or 6 years at least in our smaller foyer. We didn't really have a place for people to sit down. But when we designed this, we wanted to make sure there was a place for people to hang out. And, we want to create a hospitable environment when people come in. And so I think one thing that would help that is people having something that's, common, a cup of coffee in their hands. I think when people have drink or some sort of snack, they're able to talk to each other, be more relaxed. And so we wanted to create that environment. We felt like people would stay afterward and be able to talk to people, give them a reason to hang out a little bit. With 2,000 people, it's easy to be anonymous. And our goal is to connect everybody at a smaller level than just the large group worship.
Mm-hmm. Mike, not only stay, but also stay awake.
Stay awake, yes.
As we heard also from Mark Pendergrass, Mark, you were talking about the Sufi monks and the dervishes looking to caffeine for that very purpose in their prayers.
I've been inspired to look in my book here for a couple of quotes for you. Here's one from 1511, an Arabic poem called In Praise of Coffee, which has a religious overtone. O coffee, thou dost dispel all care, thou are the object of desire to the scholar. This is the beverage of the friends of God. And I have another great quote from a bizarre novel by Mark Halperin called Memoir from Ant Proof Case. And he really went over the top. The voodoo priest and all his powders were as nothing compared to espresso, cappuccino, and mocha, which are stronger than all the religions of the world combined, and perhaps stronger than the human soul itself.
I would second that. When I get my lull in the afternoon, I feel the power of an espresso. That's interesting. Mike, did you know that your church was tapping into such ancient traditions with coffee when you put your coffee house there?
We didn't, no, not at all.
Mike, hang on there in our Ames studio. We want to introduce also Ro Wilkerson. He is in our Des Moines studio of Iowa Public Radio, the owner and operator of Darby's Coffee at the House of Books in the West Des Moines Library. Good afternoon to you, Ro.
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. You've been listening along here. Now, the library of my childhood, growing up in Cedar Falls, quiet as a church, as a monastery, no food, no drink allowed. You have a coffee house in the library. What prompted that?
It's been there about 7 years, and we've been there going on 3 years. So the architects designed the coffee shop, actually, when they made it into a library instead of City Hall, when City Hall moved over to its new building.
Mm-hmm. How does the coffee house in the library change the library experience, add to it?
Well, you'd be surprised by the number of people who come into the library and stay all day. They're studying, they're doing research. This allows them an opportunity to take a break, grab a cup of coffee or a smoothie or a soda, grab a sandwich, and then return to whatever task they have.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any special concerns when you're dealing with coffee, food, and books? No slurping lattes in the stacks, for instance?
Well, actually, they're very liberal in that. They do allow any drink in the library as long as it has a cover on it. No food is allowed in the library. And we're actually an independently owned business that leases the space inside the library building. Mm-hmm. So we can have food, but they can't take the food from the cafe and go into the library itself.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you had any reflections about coffee house culture, the development of it in our country, and what you were mentioning before, community.
Yeah, I think Ray Oldersburg hit it right on the head. We look for a place to relax, to come into fellowship with other people, and a coffee house is a social community, and it gives the people an opportunity to come in, relax in the United States. Now you go outside the United States, and your coffee drinking is completely different.
How so?
Well, the espresso is a classic example. In Italy, you'll go up, you'll get an espresso in a Dimitas cup, and you'll take a sip, and then it's just, you know, just down the rest of it. So it takes about 2 seconds.
Bar, people, just to interrupt, people stand up there. There's no sitting down.
Well, there's
go
no
in,
seating.
Throw
yeah.
it back, and go out. Although it is fellowship.
Mm-hmm. That's true, but they don't sit there for hours, you know.
No,
they
don't.
Well, one thing we got rid of to some degree in this country, wouldn't you agree, Mark, is that you buy one cup of coffee and it's a bottomless cup, right?
It used to be that way. I don't
and
think
it is at Darby's.
Is it at Darby's?
It is on our brewed coffee, yeah. If you get a cup of coffee and you stay in the library or in the cafe, you can come out and get a refill for it.
Okay, very good. And what about at the church, Mike, per cup?
That's a good question. I think people, yeah, they'll bring their own thermoses and they'll fill that up. And if they come back, you know, we charge a minimal amount just to cover our costs, so we're not in it for the money. So if they want another cup, we're glad to oblige.
Mark Pendergrast, in your book, Uncommon Grounds, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World, we're hearing about coffee in places heretofore we would not have thought there would be a coffee shop, a library, in a church. What is, in your book, the most unusual fact or story or venue for coffee that you came across in researching this book?
Well, let me answer that question in 1 second. But I did the fact that it's in a coffee house is in a bookstore, I think, is extremely apropos. I just wanted to mention that because the first newspapers came out of coffee houses, the Spectator and the Tatler, out of the British coffee houses. And traditionally, many writers, of course, enjoy going to a coffee house to sort of have solitude but surrounded by society, that sort of thing. But I think probably the most unusual coffee house that I mentioned in the, I've got a second edition coming out this fall of the book. They now have these sort of sexpresso houses, they call them. Where they have scantily clad women making espresso for drive-through customers who are primarily male. they don't. There was a scandal actually involving some actual contact, but that's not supposed to be happening. But
is that widespread across the country in the Midwest, perhaps?
I think that I've heard of them in Maine and in Georgia, but primarily around the Seattle area. In Tukwila is where I visited such a scantily clad young woman and interviewed her for my book. They make good coffee, though.
All right. Well, we'll be back and we talk more about our fascination for Java and coffee house culture in just a moment. Mark Pendergrast, author of Uncommon Grounds, Roe Wilkinson, owner and operator of Darby's Coffee House, Coffee at the House of Books in the West Des Moines Library, and Mark Despard of the Cornerstone Church in Ames. We'd like to find out what coffee means to you. Is coffee part of the community for you? What would you your life be like without it? Do you have a personal experience to relay to us? 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Hey there, coffee girl. Beautiful and disaffected. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad you could join us over the noon hour. It's been 1 year since Iowa's Supreme Court ruling allowing same-sex marriage. Tomorrow on this program, we ask if public opinion has changed since then. What difference has it made to gay couples? And where do opponents of same-sex marriage stand now in their challenge to the court ruling? Is their call to change the law likely to find much traction among Iowa voters? Join The Exchange tomorrow at this time with your opinion. Same-sex marriage, 1 year after the historic ruling, tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, we're talking about our fascination for Java, coffee house culture in
the world, in the United States, and specifically in Iowa, where it turns up, it turns out you can find a coffee in just about any place you go, your grocery stores, your libraries, your churches. We have Mark Pendergrast with us, joining us by phone from Vermont. Uncommon Grounds is the title of his book, The History of Coffee and How It Transformed Our World. Roe Wilkerson, owner and operator of Darby's Coffee at the House of Books in the West Des Moines Library. Mike Despard of Cornerstone Church in Ames, which features a large coffee house in its foyer, the congregation with a coffee shop. And I'd like to have invite our listeners to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, with your thoughts about what coffee means to our culture, or perhaps a personal experience that has to do with Java, 1-866-780-9100. Or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Donna is joining us from Ames. Good afternoon,
yeah.
Donna. Have you had your coffee today?
Yeah, I have.
Good.
I have.
Very good. What's your connection with coffee, your special recollection?
Well, I have quite a story about coffee, and that is that my husband and I, we bag coffee in our basement. And our house always smells like coffee, especially if it's fresh brewed.
Are you roasters?
We don't roast it ourselves, but we have it roasted locally here in Ames.
So what's the advantage? Why would one want to bag coffee in the basement?
Well, what it started out as is my husband and a friend of his made a trip to Uganda, and they loved the coffee there. And they decided to start bringing home some 50-pound bags. And my husband's friend got this idea that we should just bring home a container of this, a big, regular cargo ship container full of it. And he had some money, and he felt like investing it. And he did. He went ahead and got a whole container full of coffee, brought it back to Iowa. And these two guys put their heads together and decided, why don't we figure out a way that we could use this coffee to fundraise for a really good purpose? And they decided that they would bag the coffee, roast it, bag it, sell it, and the profit from that would go to buy building supplies for schools in Africa.
So how long have they been doing this?
About 5 years now.
And how much money has been raised for this cause?
Well, every summer my husband takes over a team from the high school. He's a teacher at Ames High. And he is able to, get a bunch of high school kids and adults interested, and they like to go to Africa. We build a school. We take the coffee proceeds and buy the building supplies there in Africa and build schools. And we've done, I think, 5 or 6 trips so far.
What a fascinating story connected with coffee. Donna, thank you from Ames for joining us, 1-866-780-9100. Now joining us from Dallas, Texas by phone, a freelance computer programmer who is looking to visit every Starbucks in the world. Winter is his name. Good afternoon, Winter.
Hello, Ben. How are you? I'm actually in Princeton, New Jersey today, but that's fine. There's Starbucks in Dallas, too.
All right. I know you get around the country as well, so tell us, why set out to visit every Starbucks in the world?
Well, the original idea was just to do something unique, but after I started traveling and realizing how many Starbucks were opening, this was over a decade ago, it became a great challenge and a great opportunity to travel, see the U.S., Canada, and now the world with Starbucks in about 50 countries so far. I've done about half of those.
Mm-hmm. How many have you been to so far in how many years?
In 12 and a half years, I've been to 9,932 stores and eagerly awaiting my 1,000th.
You're almost up to that 1,000 mark. How many Starbucks are there in the world?
Well, that's hard to say because some are company-owned and some are licensed out, but my rough guess is around 15 or 16,000 and maybe 12 or 13,000 of those company-owned that I plan to visit.
How do you keep track of where you've been and where you've got to go? Have you got a big world map with a bunch of pins on it?
I have an extensive database.
He's a software engineer.
Right, right. And I track all the stores by photo, and I keep them up on my website, StarbucksEverywhere.net. And really, the photos are critical because Starbucks density in some cities, not necessarily in Iowa, but in places like New York City, is so dense that I wouldn't be able to tell two stores apart if I didn't have the photos. They might be right across the street from each other.
So what would you say Starbucks has done for coffee house culture in America? We talked to Mark Pendergrass about this earlier.
Well, what I've read, in my opinion, is that Starbucks has raised awareness of coffee culture in America and brought it to smaller communities where it did not exist, either by opening up stores there or by spurring other smaller entrepreneurs to open up stores there. And I think Starbucks has raised the quality of the coffee. I've certainly read over the years that the quality of the coffee at places like McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts has been improved in order to compete with Starbucks.
What does Starbucks think of you doing this?
Well, I think they just keep a hands-off, neutral approach. They just let me do my own thing.
I understand you are a nationally ranked Scrabble player, 27th in the country. How does your passion for Scrabble fit in with this quest to visit all the Starbucks in the world?
Well, that's an interesting question. About 3, 4, 5 years ago, the Scrabbling and the Starbucking dovetailed perfectly because wherever I traveled to a Scrabble competition, there would be new Starbucks for me to visit. Now, after the 800 to 900 store implosion that Starbucks experienced here in the U.S., there aren't really very many Starbucks to visit here, so I'm pretty much just traveling for the Scrabble. But the two hobbies went together very, very well for a few years there.
Okay, let's include another caller. Jason is calling from Muscatine. Good afternoon, Jason.
Howdy, how you doing?
We have just a couple minutes left. What's on your mind?
Real quick, like most folks, especially in Iowa, I grew up, coffee is just a way to keep you awake. When I was in college, a friend of mine from Cyprus, she got sick. I helped her out a little bit, made a couple meals for her. And when she got better, in return for the favor, she made me coffee, Cypriot coffee, which I found is the same as Greek, is the same as Turkish, etc. It's boiled in coffee, the way her mom used to make her. Mm-hmm. She brought this little hand-hammered silver pot, plopped it on the stove, put in water, and for the first time I'd seen it, coffee in, just in with the water, boiled it up, came this gorgeous brown froth and this unbelievable nutty odor. And for the first time, I had coffee as a way to kind of connect to somebody else.
Connect.
So,
there's
Yana, the... Yana, if you're listening, thank you very much for my first wonderful handmade cup of coffee.
Mark Pendergrass, in your book, I noticed Uncommon Grounds, you have in the appendix how to brew a perfect cup of coffee. What are the key things to remember?
Well, generally, you should use not quite boiling water. You should bring it to a boil, but let it go off of it. You use about 2 tablespoons of freshly, as freshly roasted as you can get it, and you should grind it yourself. You mix it with that water for about 4 minutes. You can do that through a French press, or you can do it through a drip method, or you can do it in some other methods too, vacuum. And then you separate the grounds somehow from the coffee. And if with the French press, you do it by pressing it with the filter and drink it.
I wonder, Winter, since you're visiting all the Starbucks in the world that you've set out to do it, nearly 10,000 now, do you order the same drink? I can't imagine you do when you visit them.
Well, just because it's my personal preference, I do like the regular drip coffee. But in my travels, I have gone out of the way to try out some independent shops, and what I really like now is the Clover coffee. It's kind of like a French press, and Starbucks liked it so much they actually bought the company and have put those machines in some of their stores. So I think
now these machines cost $11,000 each, I should mention.
What makes them What makes them so expensive?
They're very high tech.
Roe Wilkerson, you're listening to this. You're the owner of an independent coffee store. What is your perspective on the Starbucks revolution and how they fit into coffee house culture and what you face every day?
Well, I think Starbucks did an outstanding job at marketing their product. They took what was a regular brewed cup of coffee off of a hot plate, like Burke was talking about, for a quarter a cup or 10 cents a cup, and moved it into mainstream acceptability to go $3 or $4 for a cup of coffee. That's strong marketing. I'm interested to see if Winter has been to some of the Starbucks that are offering the wine and the beer, and they're kind of changing, changing and moving away from the coffee. We're seeing, I mean, everybody's trying to find their own niche,
right?
You know, the new thing that's going to work and draw customers.
Okay, very quickly, Winter, have you been to those new types of Starbucks?
15th Street Coffee and Tea in Seattle, otherwise known as one of the stealth Starbucks. Yes, I visited. I had a clover coffee. I did not have any wine or beer, but I plan to do that on my next visit to Seattle, and I think it's a very interesting concept. I'm looking forward to see if it survives, and I hear that they're going to do something similar throughout London, and I'm looking forward to see those stores too.
Okay, Winter, we want to wish you well on your journey of achieving whatever that's 14,000-15,000 Starbucks coffee shop visits in the world, just shy of 10,000. Are you planning which one will be the 10,000th?
Oh, that is a good question. I'm thinking once I get close, I should put something up on my website and have people vote.
Okay, very good. We'll have to leave it there. We have to run. Thank you very much. Winter, joining us from New Jersey, aiming to visit every Starbucks in the world. Ro Wilkerson, Mike Despard, thank you very much. Mark Pendergrass, thank you very much for joining us from Vermont. Uncommon Grounds, the title of his book. Thank you all for joining our Fascination for Java conversation. And it's been a year since Iowa's Supreme Court ruling allowing same-sex marriage. Tomorrow on this program, we ask if public opinion has changed since then. What difference has it made to gay couples? And where do opponents of same-sex marriage stand now in their challenge to the court ruling? Is their call to change the law likely to find much traction among Iowa voters? Well, we'd like your opinion on same-sex marriage 1 year after the historic ruling. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Now, some surprising news we want to leave you with before we end the hour. 135 years ago, the capital of Iowa was not Des Moines. It was Iowa City. For some 30 years, Iowa City served as a capital city. First, the capital of the territory of Iowa, then the capital of the state of Iowa. And that lasted until the year 1876, when the capital was moved to Des Moines. Today, in the year 2010, State Senator Joe Bolcom of Iowa City announced that he is launching a campaign to move the capital back to Iowa City. I spoke with State Senator Joe Bolcom earlier by phone and began by asking him why.
Well, Ben, when President Obama was here last week, we had a private meeting with him and the governor and President Mason to discuss really an idea that he was bringing forward, and that was the notion of making Iowa City the healthcare capital of the country. And he believed that moving the legislature back to the old capital in Iowa City would be the beginning of that. And so while it didn't get much attention during the last hours of the session, there was language placed in one of the bills to create a one-year study to move the capital from Des Moines back to Iowa City.
Was there any timeline given for this by the president?
Well, we would like to bring all the stakeholders together, the governor and certainly President Mason and legislative leaders, to talk about how we would do this. And so this language creates a study to bring all those stakeholders together. Of course, the Polk County delegation is not much in favor of this move.
I can imagine.
In a bipartisan way, leaders are excited about what is really a common sense idea.
Well, you think, you know, when I first heard this, I thought, well, that's absurd. But if you think about it, it starts to make sense in a lot of other ways. For instance, as it stands now, it's sort of confusing. Just as in the case of Oklahoma City, one expects a city named after the state to be its capital, right?
Absolutely. And you know, the president's interest in this is pretty important. He sees the opportunity for some federal stimulus money. Clearly, Iowa City is a special place in his mind. He kicked off his health insurance reform campaign in Iowa City. He came back to celebrate and really see some opportunity for more federal research money coming both on health policy and medical discovery.
I wonder if any of the practical parts of this were addressed. The old Capitol building is still there on the Pentacrest at the University of Iowa. It's quite a bit smaller than the current Capitol in Des Moines. Do you think that would work?
Well, I think this study will try and identify what the issues are. I have toured the Capitol just recently, the old Capitol in Iowa City, kind of take a walkthrough with university officials, and we think we could accommodate the General Assembly for its legislative session.
Mm. Now, how much support do you believe is out there among Iowans, among lawmakers, to put the Capitol back in Iowa City? Obviously, you said Polk County lawmakers and residents are not going to be on this bandwagon.
Well, legislative leaders are apprised of the president's interest in this and the governor's interest in this. And I think, you know, Iowa City is a great place to spend time. There's a lot to do in Iowa City. Legislators, you know, we're certainly at a lot of work during the session, but there's a lot to do in Iowa City at night. And I think legislators would find it quite a nice change from Des Moines.
I would think that you should get a lot of support from Tea Party activists. And here's why. Okay, we're not taking it back to colonial times, but this move would turn back the clock over 130 years.
I think that's an excellent point, Ben. I think that the Tea Party folks who are concerned about the growth of government, you know, we'll be meeting in a smaller building.
Smaller building.
That'll get a lot of support.
Right, smaller Capitol building would translate to more limited government, right?
Absolutely.
Mm.
Absolutely.
Do you have an idea of the cost of this move?
Well, I think the study will look at the cost. We've been assured by the president that federal stimulus money will be available to accommodate any kind of cost that might be applied here.
Mm, so we don't have to worry about this in a time of very tight budgets.
I don't think we do. And I think the other thing, you know, the signal that this will send the president and others at the federal research level, I think that this will provide some terrific opportunities to garner more federal research support for medical discovery that takes place in Iowa City now. So I think there's actually some opportunity for us to be a big winner where more federal money is concerned.
I can also think of a historical precedent as I thought about this for a while. For instance, for many years, of course, during the Cold War, the capital of the Federal Republic of Germany was moved to Bonn, and then it was moved back to Berlin after reunification. And that was successful. In fact, Germany is the economic powerhouse of Europe, so maybe this would help Iowa economically.
Well, I think that's a great example. And I would also point to our northern neighbor, Wisconsin. You know, we have a major Big Ten university at Madison and the State House, and the synergy of those two things has been really important to the growth of Wisconsin. You know, their growth has exceeded ours by 3 times. So, you know, Des Moines has kind of had its chance. And I think that the synergy between a public university like Iowa, University of Iowa, it's time to move to see if the benefits are really there.
Mm-hmm. And not to bag on our present capital too much, but also, even after Des Moines being the capital of Iowa for over 130 years, many people, and this has always bothered me, I know others, perhaps you too, Senator Bolcom, people still mispronounce Des Moines. They say Des Moines. This would save us that embarrassment.
That's right. It's irritating after 130 years that people don't have more respect for the capital city. I think, you know, that I don't know if that was debated much when they decided to move from Iowa City to Des Moines and the difficulty people would have pronouncing Des Moines.
Mm-hmm.
But I think clearly Iowa City's on the map.
Mm-hmm. And it would save us the further embarrassment of French people coming to our state and telling us we don't know how to pronounce the capital of our state.
So true.
Right. You could just stick it to the French. Say, you don't like the way we pronounce it? Ha! It's not our capital anymore.
And I think there's probably some support for that, you know, just that whole issue of language and people not being able to pronounce easy common words.
What do you think of the chances our success are here?
It's always a challenge to make these kind of big moves, but I will say I've been happily surprised by the legislative leader's support. Clearly, the governor has a special place in his heart for Iowa City, and you know the president. Geez,
wow!
Iowa City's been great to him. So, I mean, I think there's some things lining up, but clearly, there'll be some pushback from the Polk County legislators who, you know, will not want to see this change. But I think the study will lay out how to put the plan together, and hopefully we can get the support.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of Hawkeye fans in the legislature, so I'm counting on that to maybe put us over the line.
Senator Bolcom, let's say you can't get the support, even with the president's initiative here to move the Capitol back to Iowa City permanently. Would you be willing to support a compromise, say Iowa City and Des Moines alternating as capital cities, alternating every 10 or 20 years?
That's a great idea. I would be. And that's the kind of thing that the legislative process will provide an opportunity to see what kinds of additional ideas people will have to bring this together.
State Senator Joe Bolcom, who today launched a campaign to move the state capital of Iowa back to Iowa City from Des Moines after 134 years. Thank you, Senator Bolcom.
Thanks a lot, Ben. I appreciate your interest in this topic. I know it's not widely discussed at this point, and your attention to it will help it move forward.
Well, thank you for helping us, letting us break the story here. And I guess, Senator Bolcom, there's only one thing left for us to do, is to wish our listeners a happy 1st of April.
Happy 1st of April.
The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available by going to iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.